Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born in Britain. He's been a postman, hospital porter, deckhand on a trawler, factory worker, cook, and a driver. After taking a course in Scandinavian studies, he emigrated to Norway and began his literary career as a radio dramatist. He's now written award-winning biographies, histories, novels, and plays. And his latest book is Scandinavians, In Search of the Soul of the North. Robert Ferguson, welcome to Meet the Writers. If you just tell us where we are.
Well, we're at Larsen's Malt og Vinhus. That's a bar in Majorstua, which is one of the two kind of centres of Oslo. It's right next to the railway station, and it's very close to the park, the Frogner Park.
So, what are you doing here?
I live here. I've lived here since 1983. I lived in Drøbak. I'm married to a Norwegian. We lived in Drøbak, which is just down the coast a bit, till about 1993, and then we moved here. I lived just 5 minutes' walk from here, and we stayed here.
So I want to go back to the beginning, when you started this journey, because you always knew that what you wanted to do was be a writer.
It's intimately tied up with the reason why I'm in Norway, because my great literary hero when I was young, and still a writer whom I love, was Knut Thomsen. Norwegian writer who won the Nobel Prize in 1920. He has a checkered reputation because of his politics, but he was a wonderful writer. And when I was young, I came across these novels that he wrote in the 1890s, particularly Hunger, Mysteries, Pan and Victoria. I wanted to write like that. And I thought, is it something in the Norwegian language, or is it just him that's a genius, no matter what language he wrote in? So when I was 28, I went to university to study the Norwegian. During that period, I dramatised a couple of his novels for BBC Radio, Hunger and Pan. In those days, Norway was kind of an obscure country, culturally speaking. You know, people couldn't really associate it with anything, not like they do now. You know, the culture is everywhere. Everybody knows the household names of novelists and so. But in those days, it was still sort of Edvard Munch and Ibsen. You know, it was long dead names. And the cultural attaché heard one of my dramatisations and said, we'd like to give you a scholarship to go to Norway because we need people like you to promote Norwegian culture. I had nothing else to do, so I said, okay. I initially came here for a year in 1983, and in that year I met my wife, so I stayed here.
But that, of course, wasn't the first time you'd been travelling. You'd done it a lot when you were younger.
With friends, you know, it was a gang I grew up with near Blackpool, Rhythm St. Anne's. You know, we read Jack Kerouac and the Beats, and we wanted to be like that, you know, and Donovan, you know, and Bob Dylan, all this stuff. Me and a friend of mine, a guy called Nick Pemberton, poet, we went travelling, you know, around Cornwall and Devon and so on. And at one point, we actually, God knows why, because it was winter, and we decided to go to, actually, Sweden in the first instance. In the middle of winter, we didn't even have sleeping bags or cut. We had nothing. It was a ridiculous adventure. It was a sort of nightmare, really. The police kept stopping us and searching us. It was a hippie time, you know, and they didn't like people hitchhiking. And at a certain point, this is before the famous bridge was built over to Denmark. We met this guy, a hippie guy, at the roundabout, and he said, no, this is no good. You want to get over to Denmark, go over to Copenhagen. It's a much cooler scene. It's a much better place. So we got a little boat over to Copenhagen, and we spent a few months there. It was, again, very hard. You were selling newspapers in the street, things like that. But we left in the end.
You were back in England, and I know that you had a guitar now accredited on some pretty great albums.
I knew when I was around that age, I knew Kevin Coyne. He's dead now, but he was a singer. I think his reputation is increasing all the time, you know, really. But he wasn't really all that much appreciated when he was alive. When I knew him, he was working at a mental hospital. All these are closed down now. I was working there as a nursing assistant, and I was actually living with him and his family. He desperately wanted to be a singer, you know. He was a singer, and he was a poet. And we used to just sit up in his room when we came home from work and just bang out things. I was a very primitive guitarist, I still am. But he was just great, just improvised lyrics and stuff over it. I forgot all about it, but you know, years later, I saw that I don't know if it was him, had put my name as co-composer on a couple of his things. And I think even one of the tapes we made, somebody may have published it, somebody may have issued it, or a version of it. It's the only time I've ever written songs.
But your writing career continued, as you say, starting with radio drama. That was really your first love.
Yes, it was. It had a very high reputation in those days. You think of people like Samuel Beckett and Joe Orton and Tom Stoppard. These people all began on radio drama. It was very open in those days. You could just send stuff in. And it wasn't really democratic. If somebody like John Tidyman or Richard Armstrong liked it, they'll just ring you up and say, this is great, we love it, come in and we'll talk and see if we can do it. For a long time, I thought of myself as a radio dramatist because I did quite a lot of them in the end, you know, and dramatisations, as I say, of those two novels by Homson. For a long time, I just, that's all I wanted to do. You know, there's not much money in it, but I love doing it. I love the genre.
Tell me then about how your literary career evolved from there, because by now you're living in Norway, writing, you're very much involved in Norwegian life.
Well, at a certain point, one of my radio plays got reviewed by somebody who, his name was Paul Ferris, who's a biographer himself, wrote a biography of Dylan Thomas. And he's married to a woman who, or just separated actually from a woman who had just started a literary agency. He told her to get in touch with me to ask if I had an agent. You just don't exist if you don't have an agent. Completely different here. You could go in and with your manuscript, anybody up the street, and almost see the top man. But in England in those days, if you didn't have an agent, just forget it. And so I was just so thrilled to get an agent at all. But it turned out this agent didn't do radio drama, didn't do any drama at all. All she did was non-fiction. And she said something like, why are you going to Norway? Or something about Norway came up. And I said, well, I'm just crazy about this writer, Homson. She said, well, have you ever thought of writing a biography of him? And I said, no, I haven't. And she said, well, would you be interested? I think I could sell it. And that's how that particular branch of it got started.
Because, of course, you've gone on to write several more biographies.
I wrote about Henry Miller, who was another one of my great favourites when I was young. It was through Henry Miller that I first heard of Homson, because he was a great fan of Homson. And then I did one of T.E. Hume, who was a rather obscure English poet and philosopher and art critic, and died in the First World War. He's not much of a hero for the, because he wasn't a pacifist. He believed that that war was necessary and that it had to be fought with great regret. He believed that. He was an extremely interesting man. But he's a very obscure figure, so I don't think it sold any. Well, it sold some, but it didn't make any money. And then, to be completely honest, I then thought, I better do someone famous next. Although I didn't particularly like it, although Ibsen is very famous, you know, I'll suggest I do a book on Ibsen. Fortunately for me, you know, I do like Ibsen, but it's the early Ibsen, you know, Peer Gynt and Brand. The later ones are very interesting and so on, the ones that everybody knows about, but to me, they're not very personal. I always think he had to write Brand and Peer Gynt out of a kind of psychic need to do it. He didn't know himself how they would end, but I always feel with his later plays, he's very calculated. He knows how it'll end. So that was my angle in that, you know, those are the two undying things. They're on a par with Faust, Dante. That's how great they are. From then on, I was in a spiral of Mr. Scandinavia, you know. So I did a book on the Vikings for Penguin. And
you've done a couple of history books, actually. I mean, your Vikings book is considered an essential reference book, I think.
I remember I went to an editorial meeting with Stuart Prophet at Penguin, and I had a list of 10 books I wanted to do, you know, and they included Albert Pierpoint, The Last Hangman, Michael Oakeshott, The Philosopher, Edward Muybridge. And you think at the back of his mind all the time was that, given my background, you know, that he would be much easier to sell me, to get me to do a book that would make some money if I did The Vikings. So he actually suggested that to me, you know. I've written two novels. It's only been published here in Norwegian. One of them is set in Viking times, and I've done a lot of saga reading because of that. So that's really the background to that Viking book. And in the end, I just got to love it anyway. I spent years on it. I got to love the art, you know, the Viking art, the picture stones and Gotland. And then after that, at the moment, because there's great interest in it, it's the natural thing is to do books about Scandinavians.
Whilst all this was going on, of course, your TV and film work was also increasing.
My book about Homson was dramatised for a six-part television series here in the 1990s. Feature films made of it. Mostly what I've done in film in Norway has been translating film manuscripts for directors, and sometimes being what they call consulent, you know, kind of advisor on film scripts and that sort of thing. it's not a really a major part of what I do.
But let's talk about translation, because you are known as a great Norwegian translator, and of course you've done one of the most famous books to come out of Norway recently.
Well, yeah, that'll be, I guess, The Norwegian Wood, Lars Mytting's best-selling book, yeah. I've always done translation. I like doing it. It's very relaxing, especially if it's well-written. And I originally came to Norway because at that time, in the mid-1980s, Norwegian culture really was quite obscure. You know, there was no Nesbø, these crime novelists. Everybody knows their name now. And, I mean, the football team didn't even make the World Cup. Nobody even knew about the football team. So they needed people who were conversant with Norwegian culture and prepared to promote it and so on. And for a long time, that was the spirit in which I did it, trying to make stuff better known. Because I get paid Norwegian rates mostly, because I work a lot for Norwegian publishers. It pays the bills, which my writing often doesn't. And as I say, it's relaxing in a way. You know, if you're trying to write a book of your own, and you're getting nowhere, but you still want to keep going, you don't just want to stop, it's very useful to have a translation going alongside it.
Is there a temptation to improve the original?
Yes, there is, but, you know, I always resist it, because I don't think it's my job to do that, you know. Sometimes the original, just occasionally, it's so bad. You'd be doing a disservice to the author to improve it, really. Sometimes you get asked to work on an existing translation which people think is bad. Like an author will ring me up and say, I've got a book, I've translated it myself, but would you just look through it and try and improve it? And it's twice as hard as actually doing it from scratch. So I always say no to stuff like that.
Were you surprised by the success of Norwegian Wood?
I was astounded by it. I knew it had been a success here. And I knew Maclehose, the English publisher of that book, was very confident that it would do well, you know. There was a similar thing a few years earlier when a guy called Jostein Gaarder had a best-selling book in the world called Sophie's World. When it came out here, there was very little interest in it, you know. But Germans picked it up, as is so often the case, the Germans pick it up. And that's the way it filters back into England, you know, because Sophie's World sold hugely in Germany, so that they had a much better idea of that it would probably go well in the UK as well. But I think in the case of Norwegian Wood, you know, that Norwegian wave was just really rising all the time, and there was this intrinsic interest. But on such an obscure subject, I have to say I did not imagine that it would have any kind of mass appeal at all.
What is the local publishing scene like here? I mean, is local literature thriving?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You know, and then one of the nice things is that I was afraid a few years ago that these big conglomerates like Oscar Haug and Gyldendal and Coppel and Dahm, these massive publishing, I was afraid they were just going to kill it off, you know. But in actual fact, you've seen the mushrooming of all sorts of small publishers. It's a very healthy publishing scene. The Brits are much more open than they used to be. But at one time, very little literature was translated into English at all. But in a small linguistic community like Norwegian, they've always been... Translator has a very high status here, and it's very well paid, you know. Which was not the case in England, certainly, you know. I won't say the translator in England had a low status, but it was just regarded as a kind of drudge job, you know. But here, there was a high status always because of the need to bring great German, British, French, South American literature into the country. This is one of the things about when there's only 5 million of you native speakers, you just have to have these windows open to the outside world.
And do you translate the other way as well?
I try to avoid it, you know. It takes much more time, particularly with the prepositions. You know, the prepositions are the great pitfall in Norwegian. They're not always completely obvious. It doesn't matter if you're speaking, but if you're writing and translating, you'd have to get it right. I did my two novels that I wrote. I wrote them in English, and I worked very closely with the translator into Norwegian. Yeah? But I would never have written them in Norwegian.
I want to talk about your latest book, because it is so lovely. It's called Scandinavians, In Search of the Soul of the North. And it's really written like an autobiography, isn't it? I mean, it's a lovely meander through your life and Scandinavia.
Well, thank you. Non-fiction, so it bores me to do. It's a lot of hard work studying up stuff, reading textbooks and noting and internalizing things and trying to weave them into some kind of narrative, and it's often not rewarding enough. I wanted to write a book that was actually like a history book, but when people read it, they wouldn't know it was a history book. But afterwards, when they read it, they think, gosh, I know it so much more about Scandinavia than I did before I began. But that was not the intention, that was not why they picked it up. that's really why I had that, chose that form, you know, the freedom of it.
I guess the first thing to establish is, who are the Scandinavians and what are the differences between them? Because we tend to lump them all together, don't we? The Danes, the Swedes and the Norwegians. But in fact, they're all very different. Yeah. And in fact, the Icelanders too.
Yeah, yeah. It's like people used to do the same until quite recently, you know, whenever there was a television series from Scotland or, for example, or Wales and on Norwegian TV, it'd always just say English television series, you know. But now they're much more aware of it. And of course, it goes the other way, yeah. For me, the Scandinavians are, it's a language thing, really. Scandinavian nations really are Denmark, Norway and Sweden. Finland is a completely different language. Iceland derives from Old West Norse, but it's largely impenetrable to modern Scandinavians. One of the things that interests people when they read it is the status between the three nations, you know. There's a rivalry for top dog between Sweden and Denmark, and the fact that Norway's always been the kid brother. But just recently, partly because of the oil, partly because it's only 100 years old as a country, independent country, Norway's kind of sailed up to a much more powerful position within that Scandinavian Union. For like, not everybody knows that Norway was a Danish colony for 400 years and then a Swedish colony for 100 years. So it's only been completely independent since 1905. And there's still a sense of newness about it, you know. There's still a sense of... there's a very nice kind of patriotism, flag-waving, but it's completely not right-wing. You know, it's a wonderful, warm, open, friendly, so proud of the country and the culture and so hopeful and optimistic. So it's a great... National Day here is great. You should try. 17th of May. It's a great day, you know.
You're at pains to point out that there never really was this kind of monolithic past, that actually they've always been separate places. And you go into the history of the different places and into various aspects of that. So, for instance, religion is quite a big part of it. And you talk a lot about that, particularly in Iceland.
Well, the conversion of Iceland, that was actually the theme of one of the two novels I wrote. That's how I got into the Vikings. It's always amazed me that you could have a state... backed change of religion that took place in one day, and there wasn't a civil war. If you think that what they were exchanging was a culture that suggested that revenge is the best way to protect your honor, in this particular context to be a man, you know, that you must avenge a wrong done to you or done to your family. If you don't do this, it's shameful. You're letting your god down, letting Odin down. And in the course of one day, to officially accept a religion that said you turn the other cheek, that is what the hero does. I mean, one of the points I make in that novel, I probably make it in this book too, is that I think that the kind of cultural tensions, ethical tensions, it were just insupportable. And that's probably why the Icelandic Commonwealth broke down. You just can't do that overnight. You can't change from a religion of revenge to a religion of forgiveness without spending a long time working out what it means or what it involves. So that's why that interests me.
I know that it's a very complicated thing to kind of tell us in a few sentences, but... why and how did that come about?
There's a lot of explanations, but I think paganism, heathendom, was moribund. People had got rather sloppy in their observance of the sacrifices and the rituals. And Christianity was a fairly new religion, relatively speaking. It had just a few, for example, Icelandic chieftains who were extremely passionate about it. And very often that's the case. It was the case with the Russian Revolution. It just takes a handful of very passionate believers to turn the whole thing around.
There's a great Swedish story, and I wonder if you could just tell me a little about the quite possibly transgender queen.
Yeah, Christina, yeah. I think there's something of Queen Victoria about it. She was very strong, very powerful individual. In Protestant Sweden, after the Lutheran Reformation, she almost secretly converted to Catholicism, and the Swedish law would not allow a Catholic to sit on the throne. I think you had to leave the country, actually, if you were Catholic. So she kept it secret until she could arrange for her own abdication. And then she abdicated and lived the rest of her life in Rome. She's a fascinating person. And her sexuality, of course, makes her extra interesting.
There are a few royals, unsurprisingly, scattered throughout the book, one of whom was mad. I'm thinking about here Johann Frederick.
He was completely mad, but that was at a time when the king in Denmark was an absolute monarch. So nobody could do anything about it. The only person who could get close to him was his personal physician. And this personal physician was a fantastically liberal person with phenomenally radical modern ideas about personal freedom and freedom of speech and so on. Completely anachronistic, really. It's like a modern person. So he and the king, in inverted commas, went ahead with this program of reform. And of course, you know, this was centuries ago, and quickly made many powerful enemies. And he suffered an extremely unpleasant and painful death when his enemies were able to topple him.
Then we come to the, I suppose, what is maybe the heart of the book, which is Scandinavian melancholy. Because that's, I guess, how outsiders view Scandinavians, as this melancholic nation. And you address that a lot in this book. Indeed, there seems to me a kind of thread of melancholy running through it.
Well, you know, I think that people don't realise, you know, in the post-internet age, that was the association with Scandinavia. Nowadays, they win prizes for and everybody writes about it. They win polls for being the happiest people, the most contented people. All this type of stuff, but until very recently, they were the almost official purveyors of melancholy to the rest of Europe. In more recent times, you can describe this really, you know, before the internet, before the mass media, before cheap air travel, a country's art was the only way to understand or get some idea of what that country was like. And if you look at the great Scandinavian artists of preceding centuries, Strindberg, Ibsen, Edvard Munch, Scream, all of these people are extremely melancholic, if you like, realistic, prepared to look into the very dark sides of human existence and so on. That struck such a chord. Ibsen became almost an honorary Englishman in the 1890s and so on. He's huge influence on Bernard Shaw. He was easily the most famous writer in the world towards the end of his life. And that continued in the 20th century. Ingmar Bergman's films are all legendarily kind of dark and pessimistic and not at all amusing and thought-provoking and so on. I personally was always attracted to that. I liked that melancholy. And I have no real understanding of this idea that these polls show people to be tremendously happy and so on. I think they get it confused with being comfortable and secure. But, you know, happiness is a positive quality. And I think that what those polls probably show, that people trust each other rather more than they do elsewhere. They feel safe in the walking in the streets. But it's not the same as happiness. It doesn't mean they're any less melancholic. And, for example, particularly Norway, which is a country I know best, there's this fantastic debate culture. And that, it's almost a kind of axiomatic thing that if any problem arises, we debate it constantly in the papers. Everybody gets a say on television, everywhere. And that often leads to the idea that they talk about problems all the time. When foreign students come here, they think, talking about problems all the time. But what they're doing is debating think so that everybody gets a say and hopefully the issue gets sorted out.
Your book is subtitled In Search of the Soul of the North. So finally, I suppose my question is, have you found it and what is it?
Well, no, because it's In Search of the Soul of the North. And no, I didn't, you know, you can't, I don't believe that such things exist really. You know? If you could find the soul of the North like that magnetic clump, you know, this magnetic North, then it wouldn't be the soul anymore, you know, because these things always, you can never pin anything like that down. It's the journey, of course, it's the journey that's the thing, not arriving.
So this journey, this wonderful journey you take us on through the Scandinavians, I can't recommend highly enough. It's a beautiful book which really introduces us not only to those countries, but to you and the fascinating life that you enjoy. And it's a really lovely book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Scandinavians by Robert Ferguson, In Search of the Soul of the North, is published by Overlook Press. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.